very happy to introduce Anders Olofsgård. The floor is yours.
All right, so the title of the report that I have written then is Randomized Controlled Trials, Strengths, Weaknesses, and Policy Relevance. So to give you first a little bit of the background to the mandate that I've been given and what I think are the kind of purposes of this report then. So starting from the more general and going to the more specific, first of all, I think of it as a contribution to the general discussion that is going on with regards to the aid evaluation and so-called evidence-based development policy. More specifically then, as Jacob was pointing out, what I'm particularly focusing on is the effect or impact of one particular methodology for impact evaluations, so-called randomized controlled trials, and how that particular method can help us understand sort of what works and what doesn't work. And then in the end, I will also talk a little bit about the extent to which this kind of methodology, RCT, has been used in the Swedish context, whether I think it should be used more than it has been used, and so on, and what the potential benefits of that could be. So I know that many of you are kind of engaged in this area anyway, but I thought it could be useful to give a little bit of a background in terms of aid evaluation first to introduce the subject. So as always, you can slice and dice things in different ways, but one often made distinction in this literature is between what is referred to as process evaluation and impact evaluation. And process evaluation, in a sense, is the more general type of evaluation, covering more different types of topics and areas. So here we're thinking about the actual design of the project or program, the way it has been implemented, you know, including the kind of cooperation with partner country counterparts, and also what we can think about as the immediate output of the project and program as well. On the other hand, impact evaluation, in a sense, is a bit more narrow, in that it focuses only on one thing. I mean, it can be measured in different ways, but it's kind of what we can think of as a direct impact on the target group. So this distinction between output and impact may not be crystal clear. So to try to make it a little bit more concrete, think about the following example. So think about a school building project. It could be in rural Uganda or something like that. In this case, we would think about the output as being the number of schools built. It could also be potentially the quality of those schools. But we're generally something that is relatively easy to measure and is also relatively easy to kind of attribute a causal effect of the project and program to this particular output. I mean, aid is always fungible, so it's, you know, we cannot really be that sure. But in relative terms, we can sort of relatively clearly attribute a causal impact. On the other hand, when we're thinking about the purpose of building these schools, it's not really just to have the school building sitting there, right? What we really care about is the impact of building these schools on the performance of school children in this area, right? Which can be measured in different ways. However, I think it's quite clear with this example that it's a lot easier to actually measure the number of schools being built than measuring school children performance, right? It's also generally easier when it comes to sort of making a causal argument about the impact or about the effect of the project and program in terms of attributing that to the number of schools being built than attributing the causal impact towards the performance of the school children. After all, it may be the case that the actual process of where to allocate the school is hijacked politically or for other reasons in such a way that the new schools are built in particular areas where the school children are already performing better because they're coming from a higher socioeconomic group or something like that. So how can we know for sure that it's actually a causal impact of building these schools on the performance of the children? Well, this takes us then to this particular method of impact evaluation that I'm discussing in this report, or randomized controlled trials. Because the big beneficial effect, or purported sort of beneficial effect of this particular methodology then, is that it can attribute a direct causal effect to the intervention. As is always the case, I mean, these kind of methods can be applied in slightly different ways, and you know, what I'm giving you here is a very kind of crude and short version of what we can think of as standard setup, which basically involves four different things. So the first stage of our randomized controlled trials is to make a kind of division of the subjects, and the subjects can be individuals or households or villages or schools or health clinic or basically whatever, into two different groups. One group that we refer to as the treatment group and one group that we refer to as the control group. And then the particular intervention at hand is introduced only in the treatment group and not in the control group, right? However, prior to actually implementing the intervention, we start out doing what we refer to as a baseline study, which is basically a survey that maps out the environment in many different dimensions then that are relevant for the outcome of the project in both the treatment group and in the control group. Then the intervention is implemented, and then after a sufficient amount of time has been gone, and with a sufficient amount of time is basically the amount of time needed to generate the expected outcomes or impact then of the intervention, and this of course can differ depending on the type of intervention. When that time has gone, we undertake a second survey, what we refer to as an end-line study, that once again goes to both the treatment group and the control group and basically maps out the conditions then after the intervention has been implemented. And then based on these two different types of surveys then and the intervention, impact is estimated as the difference in the conditions before and after the intervention in the treatment group relative to the same difference in the control group, what in kind of lingo is referred to as a difference in difference estimation. So in this way, first of all, by having a randomized assignment of the intervention, we sort of can make sure that there are no observable or unobservable differences across the different subjects that can drive the differences in the results, which helps us to establish the causality then of the particular intervention. And secondly, by using this difference in difference approach, we can also rule out the fact that there may be trends that are going in one direction. So in this case, perhaps school children across the whole country are actually performing much better later on than earlier. But by comparing treatment and control groups before and after, we can rule that out as well. For those of you who are familiar with the kind of academic literature in development economics, and also much of the work of some of the leading donor organizations for that matter, we'll know that at this point there are more than thousands and thousands of different kind of applications of randomized controlled trials. And they span a very wide variety of different sectors and different types of interventions as well. So in the report I go through three different sectors and talk a bit more in detail about how those impact evaluations and randomized controlled trials have been done, why they were policy relevant and important, and also trying to bring up examples that show that, you know, this kind of approach can actually be applied to relatively, you know, complicated questions and across a broad swath of different kind of sectors as well. But here I'm just listing a few areas in which it has been applied and where it has also had a big policy implications. So we're talking about conditional cash transfers, microfinance, public service provision, you know, in both education and health and water and sanitation and so on, but also more kind of complicated questions such as issues of political accountability and corruption and village-level organizations such as self-help groups. But as, you know, Jacob was pointing out, we're also going to talk a little bit about strengths and weaknesses, right? So far I've emphasized a particular strength, which is the ability to attribute the causal impact of a particular intervention, what we refer to as internal validity. But it's also widely known that there are certain limitations and certain weaknesses of this particular approach. So the perhaps most immediate one that everybody would kind of acknowledge is the question about external validity. So the fact that this particular school building project were working in rural Uganda, does that really tell us anything about whether it's going to work if we're trying to introduce it in, say, Cambodia or somewhere else? After all, the kind of economic, structural, cultural, anthropological sort of environment may make a big difference for whether this particular project and program is going to work or not. And it also goes beyond just the kind of geographical, economical context. It's also about who is actually providing this intervention. Maybe the first randomized controlled trials was applied to a small pilot project with a very devoted NGO, for instance. But now we're thinking about using the evidence from that project towards scaling up the process to the whole country, in which case maybe a government entity has to take over. Well, in this case, you know, the fact that we're changing the type of implementer and the fact that we're increasing it in scale may, of course, also have an impact on the quality of the projects and programs. Another potential concerns in terms of kind of weaknesses or sort of concerns more generally with this approach has to do with the kind of selection. This method is very strong in answering some questions, but it cannot answer all questions. And if it is the case that is sometimes argued in the literature that we should only think or consider interventions that can be sort of evaluated using randomized controlled trials, then the method is basically going to determine the type of interventions we are trying, even though it's clearly the case that the method is not really appropriate for all types of interventions. So it cannot be the case that the method is actually sort of determining how we are spending and focusing our money in that sense. It's also a question about that it cannot all either evaluate all the potential valuable outcomes of a particular project and program. It sort of works better to evaluate things that are more immediate, that you can sort of clearly quantify and so on, whereas on the other hand, more kind of long-term benefits that could have to do with learning, that may have to do with institutional development and things like that, that may not be as easy to measure using this methodology, and therefore they may not be part of the actual evaluation. And in some cases, who knows, maybe they are even more important than the more short-term immediate effects. So, you know, once again, if we let the methodology determine what kind of interventions we do, we may forget about some important interventions and some important outcomes as well. There are also some ethical issues that have been raised with respect to the approach. I mean, after all, we are randomly selecting a group of individuals to not get the intervention, right? And who knows how they're going to react to that. It has to be kept in mind, though, that in most cases, we don't know if an intervention is good or not, right? If we knew that, of course, you know, give it to everybody, and if we had no financial constraints. But in most cases, we don't know, and we do have financial constraints. So in practice, we cannot really do the intervention everywhere and give it to everybody anyway, right? But still, there are also still some arguments for why, you know, the randomized approach may not be the ethical thing to do. For instance, it could be the case that an NGO working closely within a particular community thinks, and maybe for good reasons, that they can identify particular individuals and particular households or group who they know would benefit in particularly from this particular intervention, right? If this is the case, is it really the ethical thing to do to still kind of randomize the intervention? Isn't it better to listen to the NGO and target it to the ones they think actually going to benefit the most? You can also make arguments about, you know, what if in a preliminary setting, at an intermediate stage, you find that this intervention actually has very strong beneficial effects, or if it has very strong negative effects, what should you do then? Should you sort of stop the intervention or the randomized controlled trials, or should you continue with it according to protocol? That's also kind of an ethical issue that can arise at an intermediate stage if the results are suggesting that this is a very beneficial or negative intervention in this case. And then, of course, also another concern has to do with the kind of resource requirements. Compared to, you know, simpler types of evaluations, it does require quite a bit of time. As I said before, you know, many cases you need a baseline, you need an intervention, you need an endline, and some time has to go in between, right? So it does require quite a bit of time. It also requires quite a bit of planning, because it does require that those who are thinking about doing the actual impact evaluations are engaged already in the planning stage of the introduction of the project, right? In order to make sure what are the objectives we're looking at, what are the outcomes we're going to look at, and, you know, we need to do a baseline before we're actually starting the intervention. This is not necessarily a bad thing. In many ways, I think it's a good thing, and I'll come back to that, but it does require a little bit more resources in that sense. Okay, so how important are these different kind of strengths and weaknesses then? Well, I would argue that it depends a little bit on the purpose of why we are doing this randomized controlled trial to begin with. And from a policy perspective, I would argue that there are two different potential purposes we can see here. The first one is relatively close to the kind of academic literature using this methodology, what we can think about as kind of evidence-based development policy. This is more about learning the potential benefits and strengths and weaknesses of general types of interventions in order to learn about future strategies for the whole kind of aid package, in a sense. And if this is the case, then, of course, sort of questions about external validity and so on becomes very important. On the other hand, concerns with respect to resource requirements may become less important because we're really thinking about, you know, what's going to guide our future aid policies more generally. However, the second purpose of doing these kind of evaluations, of course, is just the general work with monitoring and evaluation that always takes place with any kind of public agencies who are responsible for tax money, right? So is this particular project and this particular program that we are financing, is that having an impact? And that may be relevant for discussions or decisions about whether to end this project or continue this project. And in that case, external validity may not matter very much because we're specifically focusing on this particular project, right? On the other hand, the resource cost and time resources needed and so on may be more of a binding constraint simply because, you know, we're only really looking at this particular project and program, and, you know, the budget needed to do the impact evaluation relative to the budget for the project becomes, you know, maybe a more binding constraint. So in sum, you know, randomized controlled trials is a very useful method for impact evaluation. It's clearly the one that has been mostly applied in a development context. However, it also has certain limitations and weaknesses, so you have to keep that in mind. And in particular, it is a very useful tool, but it's not the only tool. It can only be one tool in the toolbox. Okay, 5 minutes. Good luck with that. Yep. I'll do my best. So what about the Swedish context then? Well, as Kim Fosch will talk more about later on, there has been several evaluations of the evaluation work at CEDA and, you know, previously at SADA as well. And at least from my reading of these evaluations, there are a couple of things that are particularly relevant for the discussion here that are coming out. The first one is that I find, or at least I interpret evidence as suggesting that there is a certain imbalance in the relative focus on process versus impact in the different evaluations that have been taken to the benefit of process evaluation. The second thing is that when we're looking at the kind of methods applied when impact evaluation is undertaken, they generally tend to be relatively weak, and in particular, they're missing a quantitative aspect. And as far as I can understand and as far as I have learned, CEDA has been part of financing some aid projects or some research projects using RCTs on projects that have been financed by other donors, but so far CEDA has not financed any randomized controlled trials on any of their own projects or programs. So why is this kind of concerning then, and why is it a concern for me, and why am I in a way surprised? Well, you know, part of the reason why does this case is that if we look at the general discussion about aid and aid evaluation and aid policy, there's been recently a very clear focus on the importance of results, right? We see that in the Paris Declaration and the Accra Agenda and, you know, things coming out of the Busan meetings and so on. We also see that if you look at the kind of Swedish political statements and guidelines that are coming out from the government, and we can also see that in many other major donors, such as DFID, USAID, and the World Bank, among others, who've been kind of leading in trying to really focus on impact and results and so on in the process. And what I would like to argue then is that incorporating these randomized controlled trials into the Swedish evaluation toolbox would be a very kind of concrete and credible way for the government and CEDA to signal that the Swedish aid community is really taking this about results and impact in a serious way. So what are the benefits of using this approach then? Well, I mean, the obvious one, as I've already been pointing out, is that we get a better estimate of the impact of the projects and programs that we are financing. But in addition to that, I would also like to bring up two other potential benefits. The first one, as I said, we've kind of fallen a bit behind many of the other leading donors. So doing this would kind of strengthen Sweden and Sweden's aid community's reputation internationally, that we are really taking and that we are kind of in the forefront of project and program development as well. So it's a, you know, a question about the Swedish reputation as a donor in that sense. But thirdly, and coming back to a little bit what I was talking about before, I think it's also a disciplining device for the way we are planning and implementing projects and programs more generally. So, you know, and Kim may come back to this as well, but I mean, when you read aid evaluations of aid projects, many times what you find is a complaint about that it's hard to really evaluate this program or project because, you know, it's really clearly defined what the objectives are. There's no baseline undertaken. We don't know what the conditions were before implementing the project and program. And it's also unclear whether it's actually measurable, the intended outcomes as given in the kind of project or program kind of construction. Okay? And what I'm arguing then is that if you look at randomized controlled trials, the way it works, it kind of forces the implementing agency already at the planning stage to think clearly about, you know, what is the objective of what we're trying to do here? Do we have a baseline? And secondly, are we sure that we can actually measure the intended outcomes or the intended impact in this case? So it brings a certain discipline to the whole process that I think may be just as well and just as much sort of a beneficial effect on the aid practices as the ability to estimate impact more seriously. So, you know, I'm running out of time here, but very quickly then, and you can read the report for, you know, a little bit more meat on the bone here for what I'm arguing here, but some suggestions for what can be done then in my view. I mean, first of all, there's an abundance of evidence out there already, and I think it's really important that people working within CEDA, deciding on projects and programs, how they should be implemented and so on, take that information and that knowledge into consideration when they're making their plans and priorities in terms of what to finance and what not to finance and how to do it, okay? Secondly, it's also important that CEDA develops the skills to be able to actually procure randomized controlled trials themselves in-house, okay? Because I think, as I said, this should be a part of the toolbox for CEDA evaluations, and then, of course, they need to have the sort of skills to be able to sort of buy up these kind of services. And, you know, it requires some different skills and some different knowledge than the typical kind of evaluations. And then finally, We also, of course, it's not like CEDA is operating in a vacuum and can decide everything themselves, right? We're also operating with partner country governments and counterparts, and also with NGOs and consultancy firms are implementing the programs. So it's, of course, also important that all the different kind of actors in this process are on board and understanding, why we are doing this, why it may be important, and what it requires from them as well. So, it's easy to whine, right? It's easy to complain. And when it comes to foreign aid, there's no it's not like we need more whining in a way, right? I don't want to argue that. So I really prefer to think about this as, think about it as an opportunity rather than that, we're kind of lagging behind in that sense. So first of all, the fact that we're falling behind means that it may be easier to catch up, right? So, it shouldn't really be that hard to really come, catch up with DFID and USAID and so on in terms of the practices that we are using. I think that is possible. Secondly, when it comes to the competence of using or doing this kind of evaluations, it clearly exists. There's an abundance of competence. We have it nationally, we have it internationally, and so on. So it should not be all that difficult to find people who can do it if the kind of circumstances are correct. And I do, sense an increased interest from within CEDA in terms of collaboration with the academic community as well, which I think is a, nice feature for the future. And also, one thing I'm pointing out in the report as well is that I think there's also an opportunity to combine creating competence for doing these kind of randomized controlled trials with a direct kind of development assistant objective by strengthening the competence among universities and think tanks within the partner countries for doing these kind of programs, right? So if we can build that competence over there, it gives us, a probably relatively cheap competence we can use for the evaluations. At the same time, we also have knowledge and learning spillovers that can have positive effects on productivity and income within the sort of recipient countries. Okay, so, this is the last one, I promise. And to finish it off being, a little bit provocative, perhaps just to get the discussion started, that we don't have time for, but anyway, we'll try. So many of us in this room, we know from personal and first-hand experience that foreign aid can have an impact on personal income and, employment and welfare within the donor countries, right? We know that from personal experience. However, that's not why we have a foreign aid budget, right? So it's important to make sure that we also know that this is true for the actual target groups in the recipient country that we are working for. Okay, that's all from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anders.